This Fronteras podcast is brought to you by TechPont, a San Antonio company that uses cutting-edge digital technology to elevate marketing and advertising campaigns while reporting on transparent, measurable results. Their custom-built marketing strategies offer complete digital solutions and management. TechPont strives to help businesses connect with customers and effectively grow businesses. More at TechPonte.com.
I'm Norma Martinez with Texas Public Radio in San Antonio. This is Fronteras, a program about issues along the U.S.-Mexico border and the changing demographics in the Southwest.
With a population of approximately 1.5 million and 7% of that being African Americans, what do we know about the history of blacks in San Antonio? Where do we begin?
Where do we begin? The black history of San Antonio tends to be overshadowed by the legendary tales of the Anglos and the Tejanos who fought for Texas independence, battling the Mexican forces led by the notorious General Santa Anna at the Alamo. This narrative tends to overshadow all other historical veins that make up the vast, complex organism that is Texas. The documentary, Walk on the River, A Black History of the Alamo City, begins with life just after the abolition of slavery in Texas and the beginnings of Jim Crow. Living in the shadow of segregation, African Americans in San Antonio struggled and succeeded in buying land, establishing communities, creating businesses, establishing schools, and becoming a political and social force. Born Logic Allah is co-producer and director of Walk on the River. Andar Ma'at is the film's producer. Logic tells me his own discovery of San Antonio's African-American history inspired him to share it with others.
Andar was sharing with me some history one day. We were standing on the corner of Hackberry by the Carver Cultural Center, and he started showing me all of these historical locations right there on that corner. And in my mind, I thought, if I don't know this, I bet there are a ton of people who live here who have no clue that these things exist. So that's really how it started. And I think that that's important, because if you're walking by landmarks every day and you have no idea that they even exist, mm-hmm. It's important to know that.
So, Andar, what were some of those landmarks that you were pointing out in particular?
At that point, we were standing at the Carver Cultural Center. And, of course, right outside the Carver Cultural Center, they have on the side of it, from 1929, it was referred to as the colored branch of the San Antonio Library and Auditorium. And, of course, right across the street, you had the oldest African-American church, which was St. Paul Methodist Church. And then right across the street from there, you had Carter Taylor Mortuary, which is the oldest African-American-owned mortuary in San Antonio. So you had all these historical buildings, and then we just started talking about some of the people that was related to these historical sites. And Brother Logic and I are both very much into history, and we just continued that conversation from there, just trying to get a better understanding of these historical sites and people that have really laid a great foundation in San Antonio that people don't know about.
For people who maybe aren't necessarily from San Antonio, to sort of point out sort of the geographical divisions of San Antonio, it's usually pretty delineated that, you know, the west side of San Antonio is very Mexican-American, Hispanic, yet the east side of San Antonio is the quote-unquote black part of town. So, Logic, can you explain that in your film, it wasn't necessarily that way? That's just kind of sort of how it was forced down the road. So could you give us a little bit of history of land ownership in San Antonio? Because after slavery, and even before slavery was abolished in Texas, there was a pretty strong presence of black land ownership in San Antonio and Bexar County.
Indeed. Even before slavery ended, well, you know, there were heavy restrictions here in the city about where African Americans could live. There were covenants and laws on the books. And so as slavery ended, you had a population who was really striving to find land, a place to live, and a place to call home. So a lot of the settlements, the freedom settlements and the places that they started to lay their heads and establish themselves were actually closer to downtown, and especially on the near west side. So then you had the Baptist settlement, you had a spot called Newcombville. And these were little townships or little communities that had started to develop after slavery. From there on, as people started to look for or value that land on the near west side, African Americans started being pushed kind of to the east side of San Antonio. And so there you had the Baptist settlement and Ellis Alley and places like that where people started to populate. Also, the railroad tracks, when the railroad came in, that provided somewhat of a division as well along commerce. So that's really how it started. So the settlements really began on the near west side, and then people started to migrate slowly to the east side.
And so, Andar, can you tell us about maybe some of the important figures who helped establish some of these businesses for African Americans? Because of this segregation, there was concentrated neighborhoods of African Americans, and businessmen decided to, well, we might as well cater to ourselves. So tell us a little bit about some of the important figures who helped establish some of the African American businesses in San Antonio.
I think one of the figures that stand out is Mr. Charles Bellinger. Mr. Charles Bellinger, of course, won his money dealing cards, but being a very wise businessman, utilized that money to open up a cab company, a rental property, went into theater business, opened up a loan company. And he offered these services to the community because, as you say, at this time, there was restrictions basically on where we could live, but also where we could purchase and buy things. So you had other people come in to establish, of course, we mentioned earlier, the Carter Taylor Mortuary, but we had Frank Lewis establish Lewis Funeral Home, and that was in like 1909. And then we had people who came in and established restaurants and hotels, because at that time, once again, during segregation, it was limited where we could stay for as hotels were concerned. And what we found in the story is that people, particularly along East Commerce and in the Denver Heights area of San Antonio, started to establish these businesses that service the community. The people realized that because of the restrictions in many ways, they had to provide these services and these accommodations and these products for themselves. So you had people who also had little small grocery stores, nothing big like you see today, but it was community service grocery stores like in the Wheatley Courts area. So I think what stands out is, like I say, is that you found people who were self-determined to create the services and the businesses to provide for the community in which they lived.
That's Andar Ma'at, producer of the documentary Walk on the River, A Black History of the Alamo City. We're also talking with Born Logic Allah, the film's director and co-producer. When we come back,
African Americans have made a great contribution to the development of this city.
More with Born Logic Allah and Andar Ma'at when we come back. Welcome back to Fronteras. I'm Norma Martinez with Texas Public Radio in San Antonio. In the years after the abolition of slavery in Texas, African Americans in San Antonio worked hard to create businesses, establish entertainment venues, and educate their children. Born Logic Allah is co-producer and director of Walk on the River, A Black History of the Alamo City. Andar Ma'at is the film's producer. Logic says Phyllis Wheatley High School, in particular, helped mold the minds and bodies of young African Americans from across San Antonio.
Well, first, when I think about Phyllis Wheatley, when we interview people, you could see their eyes light up when they spoke about it.
Yes.
At first, Douglas, if I'm not mistaken, was the high school. And then when they opened Phyllis Wheatley, it was larger because Douglas wasn't big enough to house all the children. So Phyllis Wheatley became like a hub for young African-American students from all different sides of town. And that's one of the reasons that we were told that people really started to know one another who were mm-hmm. black, because they all went to the same high school for the most part. And it spawned great athleticism because they had stories of track stars and football stars, male and female track stars who really blossomed and bloomed there. And so Phyllis Wheatley became a place where people were nurtured, where the education was given in a fashion to help the students become more aware of who they are, to kind of reinforce what the community values were. The teachers seemed to really care from what we're told. And it was just a place where people thrived and people really enjoyed their experience there. So, like I said, when I think about the people that we interviewed, I could just literally see their eyes light up when they spoke about it.
And I saw you light up on Darwin. Yes. I brought it up as well.
Yeah, I think it's one of the places that kind of stand out for me in the film. One is the teacher, Ms. Myra Davis Hemmings, who was an instructor there. And, of course, she has a great history within herself. But also you had Samuel Sutton, who was the first principal at Phyllis Wheatley High School, and that had opened up in 1933. And, of course, when you think about his history, of course, in the Sutton family, they had 12 children. And out of those 12 children, all of them received college degrees, and 10 of them postgraduate degrees. So I smile because I think about where you not only are impacting the community, but you have that same determination to share it with your children in your home. And it really showed, particularly those two individuals, Ms. Myra Davis Hemmings and Mr. Samuel Sutton, and their impact they had on Phyllis Wheatley.
Well, you have to talk more about the Sutton family, because I don't think that people really know how far their reaches across not just San Antonio, but all over the nation. So tell us a little bit more about the Sutton family.
Well, first you had G.J. Sutton, who was the first African-American state representative. And then the person that sticks out to me always is Percy Sutton, who was a Tuskegee Airman. He was the lawyer for Malcolm X. He was a part of a group that purchased the Apollo Theater.
Someone has shared with us he was one of the organizers, originators of the New York Marathon.
Wow.
You know, and also established WBLS, which was an African-American broadcasting system at one point.
Yes. Yeah. And then, of course, you had Oliver Sutton, who became a federal judge in New York. Then you had John Sutton, who was like a protege of George Washington Carver. They were just living their lives, but we realized these are people who are written in the history books and stories are being told about them, but they was here in San Antonio making their mark as people in San Antonio was making their mark in history.
There was a really interesting point that was made in the film, and I think it was towards the end, because there is a question that you posed, what's the best way to move forward? And I don't remember who this was, but she responded that, first of all, when the East Side and other parts of San Antonio became more integrated, black businesses sort of went away. And she mentioned that she would love to see more African-American-centered businesses come back into fruition.
I think we need more black businesses. I know we do. And when I look at the Black Business Directory, I see just names and names and names of black businesses, but where are they? I don't know where they are, but I believe we need to be more visible in the community. We need to be seen and heard more. We do.
What other responses did you get from the many experts that you had on your film about what is the best way to move forward as far as continuing this African-American legacy in San Antonio?
Well, that was Ms. Vera Young from Carter Taylor Mortuary. Some of the comments that stand out to me is that also how we have to come together as a community. Another thing is taking time to do things yourself. And I think that was Ms. Antoinette Franklin saying how you have to make sure that you're not waiting for someone to come in and rescue you, that you provide the answers. If you see something that needs to be done, then do it. Don't wait for organizations or politicians. You may just have to step up and do it yourself. And if you see an organization, if you think it's not going in the right direction, as opposed to complaining, join them and help them.
I think what really stood out was the importance of sharing this history, the legacy, and I think a couple of people spoke on the importance of making sure that we continue to share the history, to document our story, to share it with the community, because African Americans have made a great contribution to the development of this city. And it's written all over the city, and I think we have been blessed with the opportunity to kind of bring that story forward and now share it with the community. And it kind of goes along with the idea of Walk on the River. It's kind of a takeoff of the poem by Langston Hughes, The Negro Speaks of Rivers. And in that poem, he talks about Africans, people of African descent, building along the great rivers of the world, from the Congo to the Nile and so forth. And, of course, San Antonio being known as the city of the Riverwalk, we wanted to raise up the fact that African people, people of African descent, has made great contributions here in the great city of San Antonio.
That's Andar Ma'at, producer of the documentary Walk on the River, A Black History of the Alamo City. We've also been speaking with Born Logic Allah, the film's director and co-producer. The filmmakers are currently in the midst of a crowdfunding campaign to complete production on a sequel to the film, which will be called Walk on the River 2.0. It will cover the history of African Americans in San Antonio and Bexar County before 1865, going back to the colonization of the Americas. Much more of our interview, including conversations about San Antonio's important African-American educational figures, the city's huge annual Martin Luther King Jr. March, and the film's mesmerizing narrator, is online at tpr.org. As we heard earlier in our conversation with Logic Allah and Andar Ma'at, African-Americans created their own communities in the years after the Civil War. Historians call them freedom colonies. Texas Public Radio's Ryan Poppy reports on one professor's effort to identify and preserve these historic black settlements.
Andrea Roberts teaches urban planning at Texas A&M University in College Station. She began the Texas Freedom Colonies Project during her doctoral studies at the University of Texas.
So when we're talking about freedom colonies, we're talking about any places in which clusters of African-American landowners intentionally came together and formed community, usually with an anchor site.
Roberts says anchor sites were at the core of life in these settlements.
That's a building or institution at the center of the community, which might be a school or a church. And sometimes all that remains of these places now are cemeteries.
She says these settlements were designed to exist apart from a state dominated by people hostile to African Americans.
Freedom colonies are really inclusive of these intentional black communities, not where people were pushed, not where they had to live by default because no one else wanted to live there necessarily, but where black people intentionally engaged in what we call now place making.
Most of the communities were built in rural areas, running up and down the Texas Gulf Coast and into the Piney Woods. Others hugged what was at the time the outer rim of cities like Houston, Austin, and San Antonio. Roberts has mapped 55 black settlements that once existed in Texas. Researchers like her have documented 557 communities that existed throughout 90 years of Texas history.
So even though, rightly so, that often all that is left is a cemetery, or all that is left is an old Rosenwald school, for example, very often there are churches nearby where there are clusters, three or four different freedom colonies, six different freedom colonies, that all return every year. And so this is not, oh, this was a, you know, forgotten ghost town and the story's over.
In fact, in many cases, that story is just beginning. Everett Fly is a San Antonio landscape architect working with the San Antonio African American Community Archives and Museum. He has researched historic black settlements throughout the United States since the 1970s, and his work has recovered the stories of at least a dozen black settlements in San Antonio. Fly is up early with work crews to clear brush from the Hockley Family Cemetery, an abandoned site connecting three freedom colonies on San Antonio's west side.
There's a post, and there's a post. Mm-hmm. And when you measure, it's 13 feet apart. And that's just the right width to get a wagon through or a truck through. My theory is that this is the original gate.
The cemetery is located down a narrow alleyway between a row of homes and an elementary school.
Using my kind of field experience from a cemetery, I said there's got to be a boundary, fence posts, etc., and markers. But we know the markers or the headstones that were known have been vandalized. And so when we started, you couldn't even walk in this far into the cemetery.
Fly has sifted through historic land deeds, spoken with families, and studied the physical markers at the site. He is sure this is the Hockley Family Cemetery, a touchstone for many freedom colonists from the late 1800s through the early 1900s. The cemetery itself is roughly the size of a football field. So far, he and his crew have marked the grounds with over 160 flags locating possible grave sites. Roberts hopes her research and documentation of these historic sites will not only help African Americans in Texas reclaim parts of their unrecorded history, but also help them appreciate their responsibilities to their own cultural history.
And so it's my intention in studying these places not to study them as some romantic idea in the past, but to talk about our accountability to these communities in the present.
She also wants her work to inform and empower local and state political leaders as they develop plans for these communities, especially those impacted by severe weather like hurricanes. The historical work so far has preserved the past for those in the present, but she hopes it will also help those in the present preserve the past for the future. For Fronteras, I'm Ryan Poppy.
Thanks for joining us this week on Fronteras. You can find the show under the Programs tab on our website, tpr.org, and wherever you get your podcasts. Fronteras is produced by Norma Martinez and Lauren Terrazas. Our executive producer is Dan Katz. Our editor is Fernando Ortiz Jr. Charanga Cakewalk composed our theme music. We close out the show with the song Freedom, performed by Richie Havens at Woodstock. I'm Norma Martinez with Texas Public Radio in San Antonio.
Freedom, 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 freedom. Sometimes I feel like I'm on the left side.